Everybody. This is a webinar in the MPRAC Mental Health Skills in Brief series. Tonight we're going to be talking about simple strategies for living well with adult ADHD. We're not going to be talking about diagnosing adults with ADHD, but the strategies that we can help people develop after the diagnosis has been made. My name's Jan Orman. I'm a GP with a special interest in mental health, and I'm here with Dr. Sarah Barker tonight. I'll introduce her to you in a moment, but before I do, I'd like to acknowledge, first of all, the traditional custodians of the lands on which we are meeting tonight. I am on the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I'd like to acknowledge the elders of that nation and to welcome tonight any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders who are in the audience. We pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islands, past, present and emerging, from all nations across this country. By the end of this session, we hope that you'll be aware of some new strategies to help adults living with ADHD and to be able to identify people in your practice who might benefit from learning these strategies. With me tonight, I have the wonderful Dr. Sarah Barker from Melbourne. Sarah's a clinical psychologist and a terrific teacher. She works with the Black Dog Institute's professional education program, as well as the workplace team, and is a wonderful person to work with and listen to. Now, I've got a picture here of what I've called the neurodiversity umbrella. I don't know if anybody thought of that idea before I did, but I was quite pleased with myself when I thought that such a thing must exist. And Sarah, what I see there is that ADHD fits into a group of disorders that we call neurodiversity. Tell us how ADHD fits in there.
Yeah, so I would describe neurodiversity as all the different kinds of brains that exist among humans. So the natural diversity of brains, if you like, from neurotypical through to neurodivergent. And the ones here would be types of brains that fit as neurodivergent. So ADHD certainly being one of them, an autistic brain, a dyslexic brain. So there's lots and lots of different kinds of brains, and this would be, part of the umbrella of neurodivergence, yeah.
So we're all neurodiverse, but some of us are typical and some of us are not so typical, is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, that's probably a good way of thinking about it. So there's great neurodiversity, thankfully, in people. And I suppose if we think about neurodivergence, these are brains that differ from dominant societal expectations of what brains may be expected to be like. So, yeah, so that's where the difference lies.
So, Hadas has said, is it more appropriate then to call this a neurotype rather than a neurodisorder?
Yeah, I tend not to like the word disorder. In fact, I wish ADHD didn't have the word disorder in it. And also the same with autism. I'm not a fan of the word disorder. So I think a neurotype is better kind of language. And I guess we're all a neurotype too. And sometimes we'll have some intersectionality with that as well.
We'll do our best to keep away from the term disorder then. Yeah. So give us in a nutshell a summary of what ADHD does to people, what areas of their functioning that it affects.
Sure. So, certainly attention's in the title. So attentional variability. And I suppose here we're really looking at varied attention. So people with ADHD can have extraordinary, exceptional attention for things that they are interested in. So ADHDers can really hyper-focus and tune in and go to the most thorough point of knowledge and information if there is interest in that topic. Mm-hmm. And if there's not, or if even if there is interest, but capacity that day, perhaps there are too many demands on that person, on that brain and on their functioning, and the environment is not really fitting well, it can be really, really a huge struggle to pay attention even to things that are of interest, or especially to things that have to be done that may not be very shiny or interesting at all.
It's complicated, isn't it? Because you're looking at lack of attention, inattention, combined with hyper-focused attention in the same person, but in different circumstances and around different things.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And sometimes frustrating for the person too, because they might not necessarily have a huge amount of control over that either, on when that's there in huge amounts and when that's not there, and that's not a switch on, switch off kind of thing necessarily.
Mm-hmm. It's no wonder these diagnoses are often missed in childhood.
Yeah.
If there's that contradiction within the attention thing, which I think is probably what most people focus on when they're thinking about ADHD.
Yeah.
What about those other issues of self-regulation and executive functioning?
Yeah. So I'd say the other two things I see in ADHDers would be challenges at times with self-regulation. So that might be with managing emotions. With impulses, there can be a bit of impulsivity at times. Energy can be really great and pulsing at times, and it can be really low and depleted at other times. Managing behavior. So there might be things that people really don't want to be, behaviors they don't want to be engaging in, but it can be hard to stop, for example, and regulating thoughts as well. And then the other thing I see a lot of is executive functioning challenges. So that might be difficulties with memory. People might perhaps boil the kettle 8 times and only end up getting 2 cups of tea because they've, you know, been distracted by something or moved to something else. But that can be really frustrating. A lot of people will talk to me about time blindness and just finding it really hard to have a sense of time in a day or an evening. So they might lose sense of time in the evening and be going to bed very, very late and just not realize that time's got away, or be on a task that's really engaging and stimulating and enjoyable and have spent 4 hours on it when they only intended to spend maybe half an hour perhaps. Sense of time can really be affected. A lot of people speak to me about the difficulty of transitioning from one task to another or one activity to another. That can be really tricky, and that can sometimes be transitioning from the shower to out of the shower to then getting dressed to getting work. That can sometimes feel like, really a struggle, depending on the day too. Executive functioning can also affect when there are competing demands. So some people on some days, ADHDers can find competing demands a great thing and they're really able to do a lot of different things at once. And at other times that can be huge overwhelm by those demands because maybe there's not enough fuel and energy in their pot that day to be able to respond to the environmental demands that are happening, the emotional demands, the human demands, and there's capacity isn't there that day. And the other thing that can be difficult for people is it's an extraordinary skill, that capacity to hyperfocus, but people can also describe it can be challenging too, because when I become hyperfocused, I might then need to go and pick the kids up from school or, you know, do another task, but I'll get so engaged in something that can really pull my attention away. It can be very hard to, pull out of that.
You know, I can see why when there's such a range of things that are affected by the ADHD, and they're not all to do with attention, and some of those things seem to be internally contradictory, that often the diagnoses don't get missed when it's not obvious. It can be quite subtle in girls, for example, in academic high achievers. There are lots of people who don't get their diagnosis until adulthood these days, often when their children are diagnosed and the penny drops and they think, hey, you know, this is all very familiar to me. So that I think from my perspective is the situation that I find the adults who come to me with ADHD for wanting help with it, the situation that they're in. They've managed okay in their childhood. Because the attention wasn't the biggest thing for them, but in adulthood and when their kids are diagnosed, it becomes a more obvious problem. How do adults feel when they get a diagnosis of ADHD in general, Sarah, in your observation?
That's a great question, Jan. I think there's a real mix in people. For some people, there is a massive relief that, oh my goodness, everything makes sense now. There's context now. There's not something wrong with me. My brain is different. And there are things that I'm going to be really good at, and there are things going to be a bit more challenging. And there's context and understanding for why some things have been hard. Maybe it's been hard to pay attention at uni in lectures, and they've been impossible to sit through, you know, a 1 hour or 2 hour lecture, for example. So there's a lot of relief and a lot of maybe self-compassion that can come with that too.
Because they must come up with some pretty amazing explanations for the mostly, well, I guess I'm just stupid.
Sadly, yeah, a lot of people experience a lot of social anxiety because they think, oh, gosh, I'm not good enough. I can't do things like other people. This is so frustrating. I think I'm bright, but actually when it comes down to it, my academic grades aren't reflecting that. The other response, and I think these can be combined absolutely, and some people will only have this response, is grief. So people are looking back at their life, especially a lot of adults who identify as female who were missed as children or teenagers, and their questions are, I wonder what life could have been like had my educators, my teachers, my parents, my carers known that this was the case for me. Would I have had less criticism or telling off or being told I was lazy or being told that I, you know, because, yeah, there's actually a really good explanation for how I've responded to lots of things at school or in my work life or wherever that might, or my home life, that makes sense. And had that been known, perhaps I would have had more support from teachers or from parents or family members or whoever it might be. So there's a lot of grief often as well. And trauma responses too would be the other thing I'd add. Often people have experienced traumatic experience, and there's cumulative trauma too because of responses and reactions they've had from authority figures in their lives.
Yeah. There are people in the chat box talking about all the other diagnoses that people with ADHD accumulate, possibly because people didn't get the ADHD right. But more often, people have a combination of things, possibly because the ADHD has increase their anxiety or increase their social difficulties.
Yes. Yeah. And they can often be coexisting, absolutely. So what people are saying is spot on. Yeah. Mm.
So the first thing we need to do is explore someone's response to the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And validate their response to the diagnosis.
I think lots of validation, validation of any distress that's there. Because until that happens, people usually aren't ready to work on different strategies or anything else yet. That really is an important part of the response.
So once they've worked through that emotional response, then we can work on their strengths. We can explore their strengths.
I'll often do this in tandem, actually, but I'll always keep an eye out for strengths. And I think this is a really important part of the work. Often I'll ask people, what are your strengths and what are your interests? Sometimes they find the interests easier, but they might say, I can't put words to any strengths. And I'll say, that's okay. We'll start to look at them together. I'll start to notice them, and I'll encourage you to notice them and see if there might be some strengths too. But I think there are always lots and lots of strengths in people, and it's often getting them to see and notice and recognize what their strengths are. Some of the things I'll see as common things, not with everyone. Everyone's, of course, different. But I think, like I spoke about before, that excellent ability to really deeply engage with and focus on interests. When an ADHDer has a strong interest in something, they'll usually know everything about that and really be able to get to the granular level of that interest and understand it deeply and have enthusiasm for sharing that with others if others are interested in that too. Enthusiasm, I think, is often enthusiasm and an openness to life and to different opportunities can often be high. There's often really strong empathy as well in lots of people. Creativity is often pulsing in ADHDers, and this is a part of the joy I think I really enjoy working with ADHDers, because they're often able to think outside the box and think of solutions that others mightn't come up with, and
brainstorm and be really spectacular in the spectrum of responses they could come up with something. So that's a really lovely thing. And also able to think well on their feet as well. So they might do really well in, say, crises or emergencies because they can just go and straight away, come up with what's needed and what's right. There's often a great ability to notice new things in an environment or to pay attention because that shiny new thing sparkles for them and their attention can note that. Variety and change are often things they respond especially well to, better so than other people at times. And I don't know whether you would call this a strength. I do see it as a strength. It also takes its toll, but and a capacity to mask pro-socially. So in meetings, it might be dull as anything, managing to look like they're, engaged and coping. And I know that absolutely takes its toll. So some people might say, well, how that's a strength. It's a coping response. But I also think it's a strength to be able to do that too.
Mm. I don't know about you, but as Sarah is talking about these strengths, I'm thinking about all the many workplaces that people with those characteristics might fit very nicely into. My fictitious ADHD person was in an advertising agency. Yours was in an emergency department. And I'm sure there are ways in which, as long as they can manage the downsides, they can really flourish in the presence of these strengths.
Yeah. Especially job design and job crafting is considered too, and focusing on those strengths, both at school and in workplaces.
So, as always, it's an important conversation to have with people, these strengths, what they are, because they may not have been able to identify them themselves, particularly going through school and university, because they're not necessarily the things that are valued in an educational environment, are they?
Yeah. I think that a lot of university students and young people tell me that universities are getting much better at responding to ADHD, and I'm so grateful for that. I think it's wonderful. I'm really heartened by that.
So let's talk about these strategies to manage the downside, as it were. Asking people how they've managed in the past useful when they've got an adult diagnosis of ADHD?
I think always, because often they actually have come up with some beautiful coping strategies that are ingenious and working and helpful, and perhaps some that are less helpful too. But just being able to recognize that, wow, there's been some really good coping here, and usually there has been. And then from there, we can kind of move to, okay, what else can we do to build on those? What else can we be adding in and doing differently? Where are the current gaps and struggles? What are the things that you find tricky at the moment? And what are some of the things that might help? And everything needs to be tailored because different things work for different people. No ADHD is the same. So, collaborating together on that and thinking together and brainstorming together and trying things out and tweaking and experimenting is often part of what we do here.
So not all the strategies you're going to talk about are going to be right or necessary for everyone, but it's good for us to have them up our sleeves so that we can match the person to the strategy. Tell us about the specific strategies, Sarah.
Yeah, so I'll often, one of the first things I'll ask people about is what their routine is and how they go about ordering life. And often they'll balk at that question and say, routine, order, what horrible words. But I'll talk about how routine's really important for well-being. And a lot of people, and I'll get a sense of what people's 24 hours is like in a day, because I think that's a really good way of knowing someone and getting an understanding of a person. Really, the only people we really know well are people that we can very, very well is when we can imagine 24 hours in their life. And a lot of people will say, look, me, look, every day is really different for me. I say, that's fine, but we need the things that need to get done for you and that are vital to your well-being, we actually need to make sure happen each week, maybe not at the same time at all or on the same day, but perhaps before 5 p.m. on a Friday or, before 6 p.m. on a Saturday, and you might have several days to get that done, but that happens. So setting up routines, setting up systems in the home for order as well. So it might be a place for everything and everything in its place, and having, say, drawers that are only half full so that they're not, falling out, and it's not difficult to find things, but purposely doing things in a way that assists with order when executive functioning can make that kind of harder. The other thing I think is automating things as much as possible and creating habits around things. So it might be every morning doing certain things in an order so that the executive functioning almost gets externalized to that habit formation, and it doesn't require thinking anymore. It's just something that the body does and happens, for example. And that might be getting up, feeding the cat, having breakfast, having a cup of tea, and then doing your teeth and walking out the door. And that might sound like, oh, you know, that's not really a habit. But for some people, that can be really helpful, just getting that flow happening. Mm. Acronyms can be really useful too. So I'll often talk about the basketballer where we worked on ball, bottle, boots, bucks, because this person would forget to take the ball, to take their basketball boots. So just things like that before walking out the door, sometimes having a little sign inside the front door, although that can sometimes be missed as well, but or signs on the fridge, just to remember those little acronyms. When I go and play basketball, these are the little things, or phone wallet keys as well, little combinations of words like that if people respond to words well. Timers and alarms can be really helpful as reminders and for also timekeeping and keeping a sense of time when time blindness might be likely to creep in. So it might be putting the oven timer on to remind someone to bring in the clothes, or, you know, if it's about to rain or whatever it might be. Body doubling too is a really beautiful technique, and this is really good for both accountability and co-regulation. So what it would involve is two or more people gathering together, each deciding on a task. This could happen in person or online, and it would be thinking about what each person wants to achieve in that time frame. So it might be 45 minutes together, online or in person. Each person says what they'd like to try and get done, and then they sit there together, or perhaps not even sit there together. Maybe they go off around the house and do the housework or task or whatever it is. They share what each other's going to do. At the end, they check in and see how they went with that. And because there's that accountability of having said to that person, I'm doing this really hard task while you do that really hard task you've been putting off, it's much less likely to go off and have those cups of tea and procrastinate and avoid, and more likely that something gets done. So there's, the accountability, but also the co-regulation that occurs there. Mm-hmm. And I'm really pleased to hear lots of libraries are offering that body doubling sessions where they'll get maybe 20 or 40 people turning up and doing something together that's tricky, great for writers, great for anything where there's procrastination around. But also, universities too are offering body doubling sessions for study, which I think is wonderful. It doesn't matter what people are studying, but that opportunity to sit down as a collective and do something tricky and challenging together and make some progress as well.
To kind of keep tabs on each other, really, isn't it?
Uh-huh. Yeah. So gamification is also used a lot. So here it's really inviting play into tasks. So it's really about perhaps I'll get a lot of people to race against the clock. So I might say, okay, you've got start at 4 o'clock and by 4:45, what do you think you can get done? And they might say, look, I can get the dishes done, I can unload the dishwasher, and I can get the dog walked. And I'll say, okay, go for it. Let's see. And there's much higher motivation with a short deadline and very specific tasks, because it's that delight of racing against the clock. And a lot of the apps that that have been developed for ADHD really gamify life and house tasks or tasks that need to get done, making it more playful and enjoyable and fun. Yeah.
We'll talk about the apps in a minute. Diaries. Now, you don't mean keeping a diary with a lock and key on it, do you?
No. So, again, these are really useful, whether they are visual diaries on whiteboards or magnetic diaries on fridges or paper diaries too, I find can be especially good. But where you can see perhaps a whole week and map things out, or even a whole month. Sometimes people will map out a whole month and color code it and have it visually available to perhaps all the people in the household. They can be really, really helpful because it's that lovely option of externalizing the executive functioning instead of having to try and remember it all and keep it in your head. It's putting it there and making it visual and, yeah, allowing accountability and checking in with it regularly too.
So what we're talking about there is a calendar.
A diary calendar.
And if you keep it on your phone and you've got a partner or somebody that needs to know what you're doing, you can sync your calendars and know what each other are doing. And there you are. You're kind of doubling up there, aren't you? What about question prompts? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so a lot of people in relationships will say to me, oh, I hate it when my partner or my brother or my parents says, oh, don't forget to, you know, it can have that kind of nagging quality, or have you remembered to? So rather than I'll talk to people about inviting partners or people they live with or work colleagues or whoever it might be to say, okay, you're about to go fishing. What do you need for that? Okay. And so getting people to respond like that rather than, I guess, being told you need this, this, and this, this, because the person with ADHD will probably switch off and go, that's so boring. Whereas if they're asked the question, A, it's more interesting, but B, it's kind of consolidating that at that habit of, oh, yeah, getting the brain to think these are the things I need. And it becomes a little bit more habitual and automated too.
So it's more than just less aggressive. It's actually training the brain to think about it.
That's right.
And of course, last but not least, there's multitasking, which some people think is a terrible thing. Are you suggesting that it's a good thing for people with ADHD?
I think it often is. And I guess what I mean by this is the ADHD brain, it needs more stimulation, more variety, more dopamine than other brains. And so if it's not getting that from one task, that task is going to become more dull and more dull and be harder to do. Whereas if perhaps someone is responding to a conversation that they are interested in, but they might sometimes lose focus. Maybe if they're knitting while they're responding to that conversation and also doing something with their foot at the same time, that is going to make concentration much higher. So I guess I'm not sure if multitasking is the right word, but I would say it is. It's getting several things done at once because the brain is then firing more often and there's more dopamine. So sometimes people will say, I cannot sit and watch TV. That is impossible. But if I am also doing something with my hands or doing some craft or making something, or then I'm able to absorb and enjoy the narrative of the story in the film in front of me, for example.
Hey, Sarah, I can't sit and watch TV. Never mind. It's too late for me to have a diagnosis at this stage.
Never too late.
So let's talk about very briefly about technology.
Yeah, some of the ones I'm familiar with are Habitica, which is an app to gamify life like we talked about. So it gets you to make checklists and do tasks and you can go on quests and customize your outfits, equipments, pets and more. And, you can do this with a friend and it helps get daily tasks done. Habitify, I've also heard very good things about. Cue Card is used for reminders for addressing forgetfulness. Goblin Tools, I feel really good. I've heard really good things about. And again, that's using gamification. And ChatGPT, that might sound so silly, but I think it's so good because sometimes the overwhelm of executive functioning can mean a task might not get done. So if it's, I need to clean out my wardrobe, but that feels so overwhelming, you could type in, what are the steps for cleaning out the wardrobe? And then ChatGPT is doing the executive functioning for you by stepping it out into step-by-step instructions. And that can make that task a lot more simple and approachable than it might have been if you'd had to, think through all that yourself.
I think we all need to think a bit creatively about the kinds of things we make use of in these situations, don't we? And maybe it's partly up to us to suggest to our patients and clients that they might like to have a digital resource that will help them with these tasks. Go on, other functions?
Yeah, so I think other things that can be really important, particularly for students and even workers, can be using the note-taking functions of technology, recording things, and voice to text, because it might be very boring to have to sit at a desk and write a report. But using voice to text might be much more attractive, especially if people mm-hmm. enjoy talking. And yeah, that's an easier way of expression, perhaps for some people. Everything depends on the person and their, yeah, what's going to work for them. But just suggestions and possibilities to consider.
So basically, once we've clarified exactly what the person's problems are, and I'm not talking about their diagnosis, I'm talking about the glitches in their functioning, there are a whole range of things, both simple techniques that we can talk to people about and digital resources that we can recommend to people to use that will help them through the downside of ADHD.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that gives a lot of hope and a lot of optimism too.
You can probably tell by my descending tone that we've run out of time. And I just want to say thank you so much, Sarah. It's been great to listen to what you have to say. So thanks, everybody. And we will hopefully see you next time in the next brief session that we have.
Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear more of our podcasts, subscribe to and review Black Dog Institute on iTunes or your preferred podcasting platform. If you're interested in knowing more about our educational programs and research, please visit our website at blackdoginstitute.org.au.